From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is pledging that Washington will rally to support to rebuild Gaza in the effort to bolster that ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. Blinken is meeting today with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, among other regional leaders. And NPR's Jackie Northam joins us now from Jerusalem with the latest. And Jackie, we hear that Blinken is not meeting with Hamas, but he is meeting with President Abbas. What's Blinken's message to the Palestinians?
Well, in some ways, it's the same as what he delivered to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu earlier today, that the U.S. wants to make this ceasefire stick, that it's imperative that humanitarian aid starts flowing into Gaza and reconstruction efforts get underway. You know, Israel launched about 1,000 airstrikes in Gaza, leaving large parts of it in rubble. Israel said it did that because it said Hamas fired more than 4,000 rockets into Israel. But Tanya, more broadly, Blinken wants to send a message that the Biden administration wants to re-engage with the Palestinian. The U.S. Palestinian relationship was in tatters during the Trump administration. You know, it had opened the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. It severely cut aid to the Palestinians and curbed dialogue between the two sides. Secretary Blinken said today after his meeting with Palestinian Authority President Abbas that he will be pushing ahead to reopen the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, which in the past has been sort of the embassy to the Palestinians. And Blinken also announced the U.S. is in the process of providing more than $360 million in total in urgent support for the Palestinian people. And some of that may have already been on the way.
Well, President Abbas, as we know, doesn't have much power over Gaza. His Palestinian Authority governs the West Bank, and his own future politically is uncertain. How does that complicate the talks that Blinken is having with Abbas?
Well, it doesn't make it any easier, that's for sure. Abbas, the Palestinian Authority, only controls the West Bank. As you said, Hamas governs Gaza. And Hamas and the Palestinian Authority are rivals, they're competitors. However, President Biden has made it clear that no aid money for reconstructing Gaza will go to Hamas, which the U.S. views as a terrorist organization. So that money will have to be funneled through the Palestinian Authority or international aid organizations. And this is what's happened in the past a number of times. You know, there are checks on where the money is going. The international community doesn't want it used by Hamas to get more missiles or build tunnels. So the Palestinian Authority is sort of a player in this and how they are going to try and rebuild Gaza.
Mm. Blinken's first stop was Jerusalem, where you are. We know that the U.S. had hoped not to be pulled into the larger conflict there, which includes these deeply rooted tensions around holy sites in Jerusalem. What sort of reception has Blinken received so far there?
Well, we sure don't know what was said in private between Blinken and Netanyahu. But, you know, during a short press conference afterwards, the two men were very gracious. Netanyahu thanked President Biden for fully supporting Israel's right to self-defense. But, you know, Iran came up and Netanyahu said he hoped the U.S. would not revive the nuclear agreement. Blinken talked about efforts to secure and build on the ceasefire and get help into Gaza again. He said the losses on both sides of this conflict were profound and that a lot of work needs to be done to create stability and peace. Netanyahu came back and, you know, also talked about the need for peace, but he warned that if Hamas starts firing rockets again, Israel's response will be, quote, very powerful.
Where has the fighting between Israel and Hamas actually landed Netanyahu politically? I know we've been talking about that over the last few weeks.
It's certainly given a boost in the short term. Remember, Netanyahu is trying to stay in office after four deadlocked elections, and he's facing corruption charges, too. So his political career wasn't looking all that steady ahead of the conflict with Hamas. But, you know, he's always sold himself as the security guy, and launching hundreds of airstrikes helps cement that reputation. And, you know, Tanya, there are plenty of Israelis who think Netanyahu should have kept up the airstrikes on Gaza to really deplete Hamas's military capability. So it has helped him in the short term, for sure.
Okay, before we let you go, we know that Blinken is also visiting Jordan and Egypt. It was actually Egypt that helped broker this ceasefire. Can you tell us briefly about that part of Blinken's mission?
Sure. Well, I mean, this falls in with how the Biden administration works, you know, building up coalitions, working with allies to resolve problems. And certainly with Egypt, as you say, it was an important player in securing the ceasefire. It deals both with Hamas and Israel. So Blinken's visit to Egypt and to Jordan is in large part to make sure that everybody is on the same page and also listening to what both of those countries have to say.
NPR's Jackie Northam in Jerusalem, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, here was a headline a year ago today. Man dies after medical incident during police interaction. That was what the Minneapolis Police Department wrote in a short, very incomplete statement. The man was black, his name was George Floyd, and he did not die from a medical incident. A jury determined last month that he was murdered by Derek Chauvin, a white policeman who knelt on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes while his fellow officers stood by. And everyone around the world knows what happened next. A phone video taken by a brave 17-year-old launched global protests and a call for racial reckonings. Let's check in where it all started a year ago in Minneapolis with Rezma Menakem, the Minneapolis-born and raised author and therapist whose work centers on racialized and transgenerational trauma. And Rezma, we've spoken before, but, you know, this day, what's the general feeling today?
Well, it's a feeling of grief. It's a feeling of the work is not yet done. It's a feeling that justice hasn't been served. Maybe some accountability has been given, but justice hasn't been served. And we need to double down on our efforts to make sure we usher in a living, embodied anti-racist culture. And that hasn't been served yet.
Yeah. Well, you talked about creating spaces, safe spaces in Minneapolis for people to go to, maybe even someone's parlor. Are people doing that?
Yeah. What I've been seeing in terms of the people that I've been holding, but also in the communities, that people are much more, especially in the black community, are much more geared towards turning towards each other and not on each other. Remember that just because we got a guilty verdict does not mean that the brutality of white body supremacy has gone away. So people are starting to gather together. People are turning towards each other and really trying to usher in a different type of reality for us, not just in Minneapolis, but all across the nation and across the world.
Yeah, how is trauma showing up? It's interesting, completely different, but I was thinking how where we are, or at least I am here in Boston, you know, a year after the Boston bombing, the day almost feels sacred, but also it brings back, you know, for a lot of people. Yeah. What about there?
Yeah, so one of the things that I've been hearing a lot of people who have lost children due to police violence. One of the things that I've heard them say quite a bit is that, you know, they love the support, you know, the things that in terms of people rallying around them. But what happens a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, when they're actually going through these anniversaries and these remembrances? Are people still reaching out? Are people still holding them? Are people putting their arms around them? And so I think, you know, we have to think about this in the long term as opposed to the short term, that that the people in our community will need support from here on out.
Look, a recent Associated Press poll showed that 61% of black Americans say Derek Chauvin's conviction hasn't changed their confidence in the criminal justice system. They don't have much. We're reading the police department in Minneapolis, which you worked with in the past, is woefully understaffed, demoralized. Have you spoken with Minneapolis officers about how they feel?
Not not the police department, but I've spoken with individual officers. And one of the things that's happening now is that we forget that, racial justice and, violence and gun violence in communities are and police accountability are connected hand in hand. Communities, black communities across the nation don't feel comfortable in interacting with the police. So therefore, when we need the police, we don't reach out to the police because we don't see them as an asset. And I think what's happening now is that, because of, Chauvin and also the increase in gun violence here, there is a point where people are saying, we need to make sure that we heal from this stuff. And the police, people don't have confidence that the police are willing to actually take the step forward in terms of accountability. So,
well, but then you have people like longtime black activist Sandra Samuels. She's part of a group of residents who sued the city over police shortages. She says, we need the police. So there's that as well.
We're not a monolith.
Minneapolis trauma expert Resmin Menakem, his wonderful book, My Grandmother's Hands, on this, to some, very sacred day in Minneapolis, a year since George Floyd was murdered. Resma, thanks so much for touching base with us. Best to you.
Thank you for having me.
This ongoing discussion about police reform, we've talked a lot over the years about implicit bias and anti-racism training for new recruits. But what does that training look, feel, and sound like? Washington State recently enacted a number of police reform bills. Among them is a mandatory 8-hour course on the history of racism and policing. The Criminal Justice Training Commission, or CJTC, called on Dowdy Abe to help create that curriculum. He's a professor, writer, and historian at Seattle Central College, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, so you were asked to create essentially a curriculum for police officers. And as part of this, you teach the teachers who then implement your curriculum to the new recruits. You created 4 sessions. And first is an overview of race itself, kind of like a race 101. Why did you feel it was important to start there?
I think that this issue, as deeply rooted as it is in this country, has been unexamined in a lot of facets. Sometimes they're not always welcome, but then also sometimes they don't even come up in some people's daily lives.
They've never had the language for it.
Exactly. Never had the language and never had necessarily the occasion to have to wrestle with these types of issues. If you live in a homogenous community, a white community, say somewhere in, Iowa, it may not necessarily be that a lot of people in that community have reason to deal with issues of race outside of what they may see on television. It's important for us to meet students where they're at.
The second session delves deeply into the intersection of race and policing. And this would seem to be more of a delicate topic because you're basically asking law enforcement to take a hard look at itself. What's some of what you teach in this session and what responses or feedback have you received about it?
Once you get into the second portion where these recruits are now able to think about their own racial context in relation to the profession that they're about to enter into, here now is where you can start to have some critical introspection. And as someone who is in education, I'm like, look, given my background, I'm also in an institution that has a historical track record of not having great outcomes for people who look like me. So I am not in a position to come in to a place like CJTC and point fingers. But as far as the feedback goes, the training of the trainers, we had 4 officers, the instructional officers there at the academy who volunteered. And there was genuine kind of intellectual curiosity that I sensed from the participants there. And that was gratifying. One of the things that I was really trying to get across to the trainers is the importance of creating safe space within the class, because the practice of empathy and compassion can elicit vulnerability. These recruits feeling safe enough to make themselves vulnerable and ask ask real questions. I mean, questions that they may have that may sound racist and may, in fact, even be racist. But they're, if they are, in fact, genuine questions, then they should be have a forum to be asked and answered.
There's another session that you do that you also feel is an undervalued aspect of policing, and that's fines and fees, bail, and mass incarceration. What you're doing here is connecting the dots between police action, say, like stopping someone for a traffic infraction, and the cascade that can come after that interaction with a police officer. This is something that we've not talked about until recently. Can you say more about this and why you feel it's an undervalued aspect when you're talking about race and policing?
One of the texts that we use is a chapter from a book by a woman named Dr. Alexis Harris, who is a sociology professor at the University of Washington. And her book is called A Pound of Flesh, Monetary Sanctions as Punishment for the Poor. One of the things that Dr. Harris highlights in her book is in the aftermath of the Mike Brown case in Ferguson, there was an audit of the Ferguson Police Department. And that audit showed that there was like multi-million dollar budget lines that the Ferguson Police Department was relying on and writing into their annual budget that was revenue from tickets and fines written to specifically the African-American community. And if you think about that, then you can think about how there is now financial incentive for the police to write these tickets. It also speaks to the bad will that this kind of helps engender within the community. The financial burden that the police are trying to meet is only exceeded by the animosity that these kinds of encounters continually create.
What we're talking about here is not implicit bias training, but it is in that vein. And I'm wondering from you, your thoughts on this, because lately research has shown us that overall implicit bias training doesn't actually change behavior in the ways we thought. How do you think your curriculum is contributing to better policing overall?
Well, one of the things that I'm hoping that can come out of this is that police culture is encouraged to be a little bit more reflective and less reflexive. Because generally speaking, there are certainly elements within kind of law enforcement culture that are resistant to having these conversations. You know, these gatekeeper professions like teachers and police officers, you know, in my view, have a professional obligation to do critical introspection on the ways in which they view race and how those ways in which they view race affect how they do their job when working with multiracial populations. And the implicit bias wasn't really doing that. So here is something where it's tackling it head on. It's asking these students to kind of wrestle with it and be serious about it. I mean, not just, it's 4 2-hour sessions. It's not ideal. Of course, we would love to have a lot more, but at least it's something that is interspersed and it's right next to the target practice and it's right next to the legal stuff that they learn about like evidence collection. So it's embedded within the curriculum, and hopefully that viewing of it by recruits who are coming through allows it to be seen as something that is not taboo to talk about and wrestle with. And that when recruits get in the car with their field training officer after they've left CJTC, perhaps there can start to be constructive kind of critical conversations around this.
This image that you paint, though, of new recruits going with their superiors in the car, having these car conversations, you kind of alluded to this, but is there a concern that you feel about the culture overall changing within police departments? We talk a lot about training new recruits, but is the same level of training being done with veteran officers? How do you see this program evolving?
So you're so on point right there, because it's probably unlikely that a young recruit is going to get in there into the car with their field training officer. And first thing they say is, so how do you feel about critical race theory? The elder officer is probably not going to be too excited to talk about that. So the kind of next step is to offer professional development around these types of issues to the upper command staff and kind of work the way down, because hopefully at some point fairly soon there will be field training officers that are open to have these kind of critical race conversations with recruits as soon as they get out of the academy. I mean, I think that reflection on part of veteran officers on these issues would be invaluable to young recruits who are coming in and wanting to learn about how this theoretical stuff that they learned about might play into actual practice in the way that they do their jobs.
This is an experiment in many ways. You don't have a proof of concept here. You've said how you expect or you want to see the program evolve. But really, what is success for this program?
That is a great question. I mean, ultimate success would be a drastic reduction in police violence. But I know that a lot of times culture is very hesitant to change. And so that may take time. But I think that in the short term, I would like to see some feedback on the course itself in terms of like course evaluations and that kind of thing. But then also, I would love to be able to kind of get data from officers once they get into the field and figure out if they're, you know, over their first 6 months, maybe, do they feel like there was at any point anything from the class that kind of helped in the doing of their job? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I don't think that this is something that is just stagnant and is just set in stone. I think that it's very dynamic and open to suggestions and ideas that different people may have as it moves along.
Dowdy Abe is a professor at Seattle Central College and creator of a course for new police recruits in Washington State on the history of race and policing in America. Dowdy, thank you so much for this conversation.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, on the federal level, Congress was expected to pass the George Floyd Injustice in Police Act today, but that has not happened. A provision to curb qualified immunity, which shields police officers from most civil lawsuits, is the biggest obstacle right now towards reaching a deal. Democratic Congresswoman Karen Bass of California introduced the bill and talked about it today on Washington Post Live.
You know, even though we have not passed the bill yet, I'm very positive that we will. So much has happened this year, and I'm encouraged because I can't remember a time in my lifetime when so much discussion has happened around systemic racism, and there seems to be a new awareness and openness to examining our history, to examining the institutions of society, and for looking at where policing fits in there. And so overall, I'm very encouraged and hopeful of the future.
Bass, along with Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey and Republican Senator Tim Scott, are leading this bipartisan effort to pass this bill. At this point, it's unclear when that will happen, but we will keep on top of this story as it develops.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Soon you may be able to watch your favorites like The Handmaid's Tale and classics like Rocky and Legally Blonde on Amazon Prime. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, which reports Amazon is poised to buy the Hollywood studio MGM. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, to talk about it. Hey, Robin.
How are you, Tanya?
I am well. So let's look at both sides of this possible deal. MGM has been looking for a buyer for some time now. What does it gain from a sale to Amazon?
It gains a war chest for content spend. We are in the streaming wars. Right. You saw HBO Max and Discovery. Everyone is binging content, both consumers and these corporations, whether they're film studios or platforms. In this case, Amazon has enviable cash. The market values it at $1.6 trillion and doesn't really judge it in terms of what it's spending on content, which it chiefly uses to drive subscriptions to Amazon Prime. And so we know you want to be on one of the premium streaming services, be it Netflix, HBO Max, Disney, Hulu. Amazon is vying, I think, to be on the periphery of that.
Yeah, they're vying for that. So what does this mean for its streaming service in what is a pretty crowded and competitive space?
It just makes it stickier in the parlance of Wall Street. Content is not exactly make or break for Amazon. I mean, it's primarily a gargantuan retailer, a logistics giant, cloud computing heavyweight. But if you're a consumer with login fatigue right now and you're out to trim the number of subscriptions you shell out for, you're going to think twice or thrice about ditching Amazon Prime if that's achieving several things for you. It's cross-subsidizing many needs. So Amazon is investing billions into the NFL over 10 years, hundreds of millions into a Lord of the Rings TV series. But again, it has such deep pockets and it isn't being judged by Wall Street on streaming alone, unlike the likes of AT&T and Netflix.
Okay, so we know, though, the power that Amazon has. The Federal Trade Commission and the European Union have already raised concerns about Amazon's power in the marketplace. If Amazon agrees to buy MGM, could this also raise those same antitrust or additional concerns?
It doesn't help. And look, this just in, I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal. It says Amazon sued over price controls by the D.C. Attorney General in an antitrust lawsuit that Amazon illegally controls online retail prices to stamp out competition. So if you think about the outsized power it already has in retail and food delivery, it has Zappos for shoes, to say nothing about books. But Tanya, I think Amazon can turn around and argue that it's in the content wars tangentially and mostly as a gateway again to Amazon Prime.
Well, Jeff Bezos, as we know, is stepping back from the day-to-day job of CEO, but he's staying on a more visionary role. If this acquisition goes through, what does this say about his positioning of Amazon? I mean, world domination, essentially?
You know, I think about this as a meaning of life question every night as I look out my window and stare at the starry heavens. Amazon is everything. Money does not seem to be an object, which is especially intimidating when this company is helmed by the richest human the planet has ever seen. And this is key. It isn't really scrutinized by Wall Street the way other pure play retailers or pure play film studios are. So it's really asymmetric warfare. And it's something to behold that it's on the verge of becoming a $2 trillion market capitalization.
Right. And if this deal goes through, it would make Amazon, this would be Amazon's second largest acquisition. As we remember, they bought Whole Foods back in 2017. That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. As always, thank you.
My pleasure.
And now a look at a migrant crisis. People so desperate for safe haven, they're willing to die making a perilous journey across the Mediterranean, usually boarding smugglers' dilapidated dinghies in North Africa from countries like Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Gambia, Sierra Leone, then traveling by land to Morocco or to join the many refugees from Libya to head out on the Mediterranean, primarily to Italy and Spain. Italy saw almost 10,500 migrants land on their shores this past year, a 170% increase over 2020. Hundreds have died, and there have also been dramatic rescues. The UN says 1,500 people were pulled from the sea last month, including 450 rescued by the NGO, the non-governmental organization vessel, Sea Watch 4, operated by a German charity. The head of that mission was Hannah Wallace Bowman, who joins us now from the Italian port of Trapani, Sicily, where she's waiting for the group's next rescue. Because, Hannah, you've told us your group and others are now temporarily barred from conducting rescues during this uptick in smugglers putting refugees into boats. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But does this increase, does it feel different on your end? How would you describe it for us?
For me, it's a human face. I'm remembering the people that we've had on deck over the past weeks during the rescues that we did in the central Mediterranean. We did six rescues within the space of just over 48 hours. And these are men, these are women, these are children. On one boat, we had, I think it was over 52 unaccompanied minors aged around 14 years old, some of whom have been on the move for several years. So there's a disconnect between the kind of statistical information, which feels very disjointed from my own kind of personal experience.
Yeah, yeah. But can you, one face is enough. I mean, I don't know what I'd do, you know, if I came across somebody in an open sea who was desperate and needed help. One is enough. But can you feel a sense that there's more?
Yes, indeed. You do get a sense that there are many people who are on the move, and we're hearing about shipwrecks happening in real time, but unable to do anything about it. It's a very difficult situation to be in when we are being obstructed and kind of criminalized as we are.
Yeah. Well, first, why are you being blocked? Why stop you during an uptick in smuggling?
Well, according to the Italian authorities, it's about concerns for our passengers, which is a type of language which is it's dangerously misleading, because actually we're talking about survivors of shipwreck, people who would otherwise be left to drown, and for whom we kind of have this shared humanitarian imperative to rescue. But of course, Italy has been somewhat abandoned by the European Union and other member states to deal with this issue on its own. And as such, it's an issue which has been highly politicized. And migrants, refugees, asylum seekers have been systematically othered by the narrative. And we are the scapegoat to that.
Well, we'll mention that the UN is urging Italy to let you continue your good work. But meanwhile, why are these migrants coming, and where are they coming from?
So during the last rescue mission of the Sea-Watch 4, we met people coming from a diversity of nationalities. One common denominator would be that they are fleeing from Libya, a country which is categorically defined as unsafe by international institutions, the European Commission, where people are fleeing from torture, systematic violence, extortion. We hear from people who have been forced to call their families while being burnt with melted plastic, while being cut by people who keep them imprisoned in various different capacities in order that their family members will hear the pain that they're in and send money in order that they're released. But one thing that, as I say, is kind of common is this cyclical violence. People are desperate for a means of escape, and so desperate, in fact, that they're willing to go to sea in these very flimsy wooden and rubber boats. It really doesn't take very much for the whole structure to disintegrate, for people to end up in the water. And the people who are on these boats oftentimes can't swim. Sometimes they've been at sea for an extended period of time, very dehydrated, covered in fuel burns, very panicked, obviously, as you can imagine, because despite the hope that they will make it to some sort of better future or a safe haven, the reality is they put out to a horizon not knowing if they'll ever step onto dry land again.
Well, and you see these people when you're aboard Sea-Watch 4. What's their reaction when they realize they're being saved?
It can be pretty overwhelming. Sometimes people have been at sea for many, many hours, sometimes days, close to a week in some instances. And at the moment that they step foot onto our deck, the kind of adrenaline leaves their body at that moment, and oftentimes people will collapse and they really need... sorry, I've got an alarm going off on the bridge. Yeah, and it really takes every effort on the part of the crew and the people themselves to help them get those last few meters so we can give them a drink of water, provide them an emergency blanket, that kind of first humanitarian aid. One of the refrains that was quite common during the last rescue mission was people reflecting that they were being treated for the first time like another human being. And that's very moving to hear. I mean, that would be the base level, that, you know, somebody being grateful to you for recognizing them as existing in a human capacity. And of course, that's pretty devastating to hear.
Where do they go from you once you've rescued them? Do you have to turn them over to officials?
So once the people are on board the ship, we request a place of safety from the relevant maritime authority. And the closest place of safety for us operating in the central Mediterranean is Italy or Malta. Malta have completely reneged they ignore their responsibility. So for the most part, people end up in Italy.
Well, as we said, you've been stopped for now from going out again. We're talking to you right on the boat. We just heard some sounds from the bridge there. Do you anticipate going soon? What are your thoughts?
So we are actually appealing to the European Court of Justice for the ship's release. Basically, state bureaucracy is being leveraged as a means to prevent us from returning to sea. And at the same time, European money is being channeled to the Libyan Coast Guard. And the Libyan Coast Guard are basically funded to prevent people from trying to escape from Libya and taking them back to the country they're trying to flee. And if I may, I would just add that during this last rescue, we were actually on scene of a very violent interception by the Libyan Coast Guard. We were about to rescue the people on a very overcrowded rubber boat, and the Libyan authorities arrived on scene and chased the people down. The people didn't want to stop. They ended up beating them away from the engine in order to capture them, and we were forced to leave the scene. It was really, really a devastating moment for the crew. And, I mean, the amount of times I've heard the words, I'd rather die. I'd rather die than go back to Libya. And coming from the mouths of 12, 13, 14-year-old kids, we know what people are going back to. So being in that situation, seeing it play out, knowing there's nothing we can do to stop it, and now being in a situation where we're unable to sail, it's really quite devastating.
But Hannah Wallace-Bowman, can you understand how people in Italy might be thinking, we can't encourage this, because first of all, people are dying trying to make this crossing. We can't let them think that it's something they should try, and we can't absorb this many people.
Yeah, when people have no other option, this is what happens. And manifesting shipwrecks is not the answer to migration. Building the walls higher is not the answer to migration. There's nothing common sense about the bodies of people being left unidentified and drifting in the Mediterranean Sea. And what we're experiencing now is the central Mediterranean being used as a tactic of dissuasion, that people are being left to drown in order to secure our borders. And we're not addressing the fundamental questions as to why people move. And unless we do so, this situation will continue to manifest. And that's one of the reasons that I find it difficult to refer to it as a crisis, because this is a systemic issue. And we need to change the way we approach people on the move and the way we understand why it is that people move. And the people that we rescue, they are not the problem to eliminate.
Hannah Wallace-Bowman, she heads missions aboard the Sea-Watch 4 rescue vessel, now docked in Italy, hoping to get back out in the Mediterranean. Hannah, thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Here in California, about 3/4 of the state is now experiencing extreme drought. It's the second year of dryness. And while there's concern about water for drinking and agriculture, the biggest worry is the possibility of devastating wildfires. To help prevent these fires, California Governor Gavin Newsom has proposed massive spending on prescribed burns, that is, setting small fires on purpose. As we hear from Danielle Vinton of member station KQED, in this story that first aired on Weekend Edition, a prescribed burn helped save one community last year.
In the foothills of California's Sierra Nevada mountains sits Rock Haven. It's a small, private holding in a forest of cedar, fir, and pine trees. And for years, it was a ticking fire time bomb, as throughout the West, natural fire had been suppressed for a century.
We had at Rock Haven 6 times as much fire fuel on the ground as the average for California. Well, you could imagine that's a hell of a lot of stuff that can burn.
Jennifer Mew White lives in the East Bay. She's the fourth generation of her family to use a cabin near Shaver Lake and is part of the association that collectively owns the land. She and her husband worked hard to convince everyone else they had to do something about fire risk.
We've been talking to our members for, you know, maybe almost 20 years.
But many of the families were reluctant. A century ago, a lumber company cut most of the trees in the area. And when the forest came back, people loved the trees and wanted to protect them. The idea that it was good to cut crowded trees and set prescribed fires was a non-starter.
We had rules in our association with you not to cut a tree and, you know, trees are sacred and blah, blah, blah.
But by 2014, there was a new threat. During a punishing drought, bark beetles began killing entire stands of trees, making the fire risk even worse. Mew White finally convinced her neighbors to hire a forester. Julianne Stewart told them taking action was urgent.
So it was a really neat process and kind of bringing that group of people together to realize, like, we're on the precipice. We have an emergency. Our trees are dying. We need to do something.
People compromised and made a plan. Then came the question of money.
We never would have been able to pay for all of that in a timely manner.
It can run up to $5,000 an acre to clean up, recover, and maintain a forest. That would mean about $1 million for Rockhaven. And while the cabins are beautiful, that doesn't mean the families they've been passed down to have a lot of money.
The one shining beacon of light was the California Forest Improvement Program.
It's run by CAL FIRE, the state fire agency. And Forester Stewart says it picked up most of the cost, helping homeowners hire foresters to write management plans, meet state regulations, and pay contractors to do the labor. Still, even paying 10% of the cost was a big investment for Rockhaven. So they chose to start with just half the property.
The most valuable part is where the cabins are.
They finished the work just months before the Creek Fire ignited last September, devouring forests in 100-degree temperatures and high winds.
An inferno raging out of control tonight in California's Sierra National Forest.
Visit Rockhaven today, and you can see that forest management work made a stunning difference.
How about this one?
At the edge of the treatment area, Stewart inspects a fir tree. The top is green, but the bottom branches are singed, probably dead. Right here is the zone where the fire transitioned and laid down on the ground.
I mean, really, that's ideal. That tree, as it grows, it's eventually going to drop those lower branches because they were killed during the fire.
It's almost like self-pruning.
And it's making itself more fire resilient for another fire that might come in the future.
Within literal spitting distance, where there was no management, it looks like a sand dune, punctured by burned matchsticks.
I wish that I could show you a picture of what this looked like before, because now when I look out there, like, there's literally nothing alive.
Stewart, the forester, doesn't believe any of these cabins would have survived the fire. But in the end, they weren't even singed. In part, because there was another benefit to treating this land.
No question, Shaver would have been a lot more difficult to defend.
CAL FIRE's Jim McDougald, assistant fire chief in Fresno County, says he knew about the work at Rockhaven and knew his crews could go in and bulldoze a fire line safely. Stopping the fire there made it easier for firefighters to protect the rest of the town of Shaver Lake about a mile away.
I don't know that we'd have been that successful if it wasn't for the fuel break and the work that had been done on the logging and stuff like that around it to reduce the fuels.
Rockhaven and Shaver Lake got lucky. The work they did ahead of time paid off and saved homes, possibly lives. Dozens of other forest towns in these mountains have yet to do the same. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Venter.
We're glad you're listening to us on your local public radio station, and you can keep the conversation going with us on Twitter. You can find me at Tanya Mosley. Peter is at O'Dowd Peter.
I'm at Here and Now Robin, and you can get to know our small but noble and valiant team that puts the show together every day. Find all of them at hereandnow.org. Just click on Meet the Staff.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.